I'd like for you to open your Bible to Joshua chapter 24, verse 32, first. There's a little story here at the end of the book of Joshua that I believe is connected to the story we just finished, which was the blessing and cursing ceremony that had been prescribed by Moses to take place shortly after the Israelites arrived in their promised land. And I believe that Joshua, after taking Jericho, and then after taking Ai, and I believe Bethel, pushed northward and took Shechem so that they could have this ceremony in the very first year they were in the Promised Land. And I actually believe they were there in time for the seventh month, the festival of harvest known as Sukkot, or the Feast of Tabernacles, and that would all take place in connection with the blessing and cursing ceremony. Now, you might remember there's also some other things they're supposed to do here. They're supposed to set up standing stones and whitewash them and put the words of the covenant upon them, and then do the blessing and cursing ceremony back and forth between the two mountains that are right on either side of Shechem. So it's a pretty big thing that they're at Shechem and doing all of this. But there's another thing that they had to take care of, and I think it makes sense that they did it now. Joshua 24, verse 32 says, "As for the bones of Joseph, which the people of Israel brought up from Egypt," so they brought a sarcophagus that had the mummified body of Joseph inside of it, because he had instructed his family members that when the fulfillment of the prophecy of Israel leaving Egypt took place, he didn't want his body left behind. He wanted it taken back to the Promised Land, because that's where he'd been born, and interred there. And so here it is. They buried them, the bones, the mummified remains, at Shechem, in the piece of land that Jacob bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of money, or 100 pieces of silver. So way back when Jacob first came to Shechem, he entered into some sort of land contract, water rights, herding contract with the head of Shechem. And that allowed him to pitch his tent and run his sheep and his goats. And we know that he also dug a well at Shechem. And so that's the piece of property that's being referenced here. And so that is where Joseph's bones are interred. And this, then, we are told, became an inheritance of the descendants of Joseph. So the area right around the city of Shechem, where the old encampment for Jacob was located, will go in the dividing up of the land, the allotment of the inheritance, to Joseph's family, so that they will be near his tomb. So that, I think, brings us to the end of the major activities in the first year that the Israelis were in the Promised Land. Now, they would have, in the fall of this first year, which I believe is 1416 B.C., they would have prepared the ground and planted their very first grain crops in the Promised Land, the parts that they had control of. And then they would have settled down for the late fall and then through the winter. It was typical that nobody in the ancient world engaged in military activity of any sort from late fall until the very beginning of spring, the late spring, late winter, early spring say right around March or so. So I believe we're done with the first year of Israel being in the Promised Land. During this lull of military activity, the next story happens. Joshua chapter 9, verse 1. As soon as all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland, all along the coast of the Great Sea, that's the Mediterranean, toward Lebanon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites heard of this. They gathered together as one to fight against Joshua and Israel. Now, that shouldn't surprise any of us. Joshua and his people have established a beachhead in Canaan. They took the crossing point of the lower Jordan there at Jericho. Then they pushed westward up to the crossroads of trade that is at Ai and Bethel. They then went northward along that the north-south trade route until they finally came to Shechem, about 20-some miles to the north. And all of that is now under the control of the Israelis. And I would suggest to you that they also went back down to the Jordan from Shechem and basically solidified a great big 400 mile square region, approximately, that is inside that that particular perimeter. And that's probably where they've planted all their grain crops. And they've got their military, mostly the militias, down at Gilgal, I think, because that's where the main encampment is. But they're also probably got outposts all along that perimeter to protect their people who are trying to carry on agricultural pursuits. Now, down to the south, the hill country that we're talking about here, and then over to the west and the southwest, the Canaanites are thinking, we can't let those guys stay there. If they stay there, they will push into our territory, which, of course, is correct. But their plan to mobilize the following spring has a little bit of a monkey wrench thrown into the gears. Verse 3. When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai. Now, Gibeon is a significant walled city of the Canaanites that's only a few miles to the south and a little bit west from Ai and from Bethel. I think it's like 8 miles from where we think those cities are. It sits at the head of two valleys that go down toward the Mediterranean coastline. And it controls those two valleys, which are part of this east-west trade route that comes across the Jordan at Jericho. And so the Gibeonites realize that they are definitely in the crosshairs for any future operations by the Israelis, because the Israelis will certainly want to control the full length of this east-west trade route. So what do? Verse 4. They, on their part, acted with cunning. They went and made ready provisions and took worn-out sacks for their donkeys and wineskins that were worn out and torn and mended, with worn-out patched sandals on their feet and worn-out clothes, and all their provisions were dry and crumbly. Now we'll understand why they've kitted themselves up in this way in a moment. they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal. Now, it doesn't say it in the text, but my guess is they didn't just simply come down that east-west highway to Gilgal and present themselves, because that would mean they were coming from the direction of Canaanite territory. I actually think they went to the trouble of going way far around, either around the south side of the Dead Sea or way north up by the Sea of Galilee, and worked their way around and came to the Jordan crossing from the east. So they would look like they were coming from a long ways away. So they went to Joshua at the camp at Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel. And when we're talking about the men of Israel here, we're talking about the leadership council, the Sanhedrin, the 70. We have come from a distant country. So now make a covenant with us. So we want to make a deal. But the men of Israel said to the Hivites, because the Gibeonites are part of that people group, the subgroup of Canaanites that are called the Hivites. Perhaps you live among us. Then how can we make a covenant with you? So it is, I think, understood by the Canaanites somehow that anyone living inside the boundaries of the Promised Land is on God's hit list. They are to be executed. It could be that prophets through the years have made this pretty clear. When the Israelis are acting as God's sheriff to kick them out, that only applies to Canaanite territory. It doesn't apply outside the boundaries of Canaan. The Israelis can actually make deals with non-Canaanites. So that's why these guys want to act as if they're not from inside the boundaries. Verse 8. They said to Joshua, "Oh, we're your servants," or perhaps, "We want to be your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Well, who are you? Where do you come from?" And they said to him, very vaguely again, "From a very distant country your servants have come because of the name of He who is your God." Now, I will confess, that catches my attention. It is something similar to what Rahab tells the spies that stay at her house. That these guys are saying, "We are impressed by the stories we're hearing about your God, He who is. And so we've come here because we would like very much to know more about Him." And I think it's implied that they're saying, "And we would even be interested in serving Him." So I believe that these guys are one of the few groups inside Canaan that is open to conversion to the true God, worshiping the true Creator God and throwing off their pagan past, and that they are communicating that with these words. "For we have heard a report of Him and all that He did in Egypt and all that He did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth." Now, that those events are getting farther and farther in the past, but the defeat of the two kings in Transjordan, that's still pretty fresh, because if we're in the second year of Israel being in the land, then that was only two calendar years ago. And so these guys are saying, "We know your God is important." In fact, everybody back home knows that. Verse 11, "So our elders, all the inhabitants of our country, said to us, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey. Go to meet them and say to them, we are your servants. Come now, make a covenant with us.'" So their communication is, everybody in our land, everybody in our country, all of our ethnic group wants to be allies with you, and we want to know more about He who is. And then comes the reason for their supplies being in the state they're in. Well, here's our bread. It was still warm when we took it from our houses as our food for the journey on the day we set out to come to you. But now, behold, it's dry and crumbly. These wineskins were new when we filled them, and behold, they've burst. Wineskins are exactly as it describes here. They are skins of animals that have been filled with grape juice. And then as the grape juice ferments, it stretches the wineskin. And if you use old ones, you can't put as much grape juice into it. That's especially true if you're using old wineskins that have been mended in some way. So they've used very old wineskins, and now they're claiming, you see, when we started out, you know, earlier in our journey, all this stuff was brand new and fresh. But look at it now. The process of fermentation that's happening while we were on our trip is already starting to make these things old, stretching them out. These garments and these sandals of ours are worn out from the very long journey. So these guys are pretending like they're from months and months and months of travel away, when in fact, they're only 3 days from Gilgal. Now this is where Joshua and Israel do something that will be critiqued. And that is, they don't check in with God. Verse 14. So the men took some of their provisions. So they looked at their stuff and went, yeah, it does all look very old. You must have been on the journey for months. Yeah, you can't be one of the Canaanites then. But they did not ask counsel from He who is. Says it right there in the text. They failed to check in with the king. So they made assumptions that were incorrect. And Joshua is part of this assumption. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live, and the leaders of the congregation swore to them. And so they swear to them in the name of He who is. And that means they can't go back on this. And it does not matter. I get this asked this question all the time when I teach this section. It does not matter that the Gibeonite group lied. Once the Israelites made an oath, a promise in the name of He who is, they were duty-bound to keep their promise, regardless of what the other side had done. They should have checked with God before making the oath. That's what the text indicates. So they probably have a feast, because most covenants are sealed with feasts, and then they disappear. They go on their journey, presumably many, many months back to where they came from. But then something happens. Verse 16, at the end of 3 days, after they'd made a covenant with them, they heard that they were their neighbors and that they lived among them. Not sure how this happened, but somehow it comes out, perhaps in a spying situation, that they're just up and over the ridgeline from Gilgal. They're only a handful, double handful of miles from Ai. And so what are they going to do about it? Verse 17, the people of Israel set out. They reached their cities on the third day. Now that's only partial travel on the first and the third day in order to get there. Now their cities were Gibeon, that's the chief one, Kephira, Beerot and Kiriath Yearim. And we know where at least a couple of those are definitely located, right there in those valleys that I was describing earlier. But the people of Israel did not attack them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by He who is the God of Israel. And then all the congregation murmured against the leaders. So the common people are ticked off that the leaders have made an oath to these people that they will not be run out of the country, they won't be executed, their properties won't become the properties of Israelis. And you can appreciate that some of them might have been looking at those properties. Perhaps that's the spying situation that actually led to them finding out that these Gibeonites were nearby. They won't get that nice property because the leadership didn't check in with God. Verse 19, but all the leaders said to all the congregation, we've sworn to them by He who is the God of Israel, and now we may not touch them. This we will do to them. Let them live, lest wrath come upon us because of the oath that we swore to them. And the leaders said to them, let them live. And so they became cutters of wood, drawers of water for all the congregation, just as the leaders had said of them. So they end up becoming workers, hard workers, for the tabernacle in particular, to supply the tabernacle with wood and water. And that's a lot of work because the tabernacle burns up a lot of wood every single day, and it uses an awful lot of water every single day. And that's hard labor that Israelis may not have wanted to do. So these guys become laborers for the tabernacle. Now Joshua, who didn't check in with God, mind you, still has some words for them. Joshua summoned them and he said to them, why did you deceive us, saying we were very far from you when you dwell with among us? Now therefore you are cursed, and some of you shall never be anything but servants, cutters of wood, drawers of water for the house of my God. Now, we will later see a change in the situation for these people, at least in the way they are perceived. Right now, they are thought of as non-Israelis who were on a hit list, they were on an execution list, but ended up using lies to keep their property, keep their position. But eventually, they will, as a people group, embrace the worship of the one true and living God, and their jobs will shift from the tabernacle to the temple built by Solomon. And these people will be honored workers in the temple compound. And they will be respected members of Israeli society. And so time changes some of the attitudes on this story. But at this time, they answer to Joshua, because it was told to your servants for a certainty that He who is your God had commanded His servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land from before you. So we feared greatly for our lives because of you and did this thing. And now, behold, we're in your hand. Whatever seems good and right in your sight to do to us, do it. So if you feel that we need to be permanent workers for the tabernacle, hard labor, that's fine, because we just want to live. So Joshua did this thing to them and delivered them out of the hand of the people of Israel, and they did not kill them. And Joshua made them that day cutters of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of He who is to this day in the place that he should choose. And so this is how the Gibeonites became closely associated with the Israeli tabernacle worship ceremonies because they supply the material, wood and water, that's used in it. The next story is a reaction to that. Chapter number 10. As soon as Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard how Joshua had captured Ai and had devoted it to destruction, doing to Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king, and how the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were among them, he feared greatly, because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were warriors. So the king of Jerusalem is only a few miles to the south and east of Gibeon, which now belongs to the Israelis. The Israelis now control the east-west roadway from the Jordan all the way, at least most of the way, over to the Med, if not all the way to the Med, but certainly the entire valley that belonged to the Gibeonites. So Jerusalem's territory is now directly under threat for being taken next. And so this guy is ready to do whatever it takes in order to stop that from happening. And so what he will do is make a great big alliance with all the other kings of city-states to the south of him, and they will push back against Gibeon first, because that's the most recent part of the beachhead, and they're hoping they can take that property back.